43, numeric and alphanumeric displays for instruments. I'm Bert Frescura from Hewlett-Packard. In this session, we will discuss three display technologies: liquid crystals, light-emitting diodes, and plasmas, and their applications to instruments. With the current rapid growth of the LED and plasma display technologies and calculators, I think we begin to see a whole new era developing in the instrument market. Where it goes and what it does is going to depend on how ingenious we are and how good a job we do of using these new technologies. Today, I hope, will be a step in the right direction. We will start with three papers, one on each technology, which will be 25 minutes in length. We will follow each of the papers with a 5-minute question and answer period. After the three papers have been completed, we will then have a discussion with the three speakers and the audience. And let me emphasize that we would like to have audience participation, and that'll be an integral part of the discussion. We hope that the three papers will serve to stimulate questions from the audience. The first paper will be presented by Bob Clary of Optical Coating Laboratories, and he has some interesting comments to make on liquid crystal displays. Bob got his BS from Rensselaer Polytechnic and his MS in Engineering Physics from Drexel Institute. He's had 12 to 13 years in vacuum process experience, and he's now program manager for liquid crystal displays at Optical Coating Laboratories, where he's been for the last 5 years. Bob?
Well, in this paper, I'll try to first of all briefly describe the type of liquid crystal displays or liquid crystal materials, the modes of operation, the mounting techniques, some lifetimes. In general, try to give you a background on the technology very quickly, and then shift into a visual demonstration of the various types of liquid crystal displays. The presentation is mostly intended to give you this visual feel for what's going on and what the possibilities are. So I'll try to go very swiftly through the preliminaries of what liquid crystal displays are and how they're made. If I could have slide one. There are three general types of liquid crystal materials. This slide gives an indication as to why they're called crystals, even though they are liquid. This type in the upper left is the pneumatic type, and the molecules are aligned parallel to one another. They don't change their molecular axis except over dimensions that are rather long compared to the molecular dimensions. This type over here on the right is cholesteric, and here a higher order exists. The molecules lie in layers, and they're parallel to one another in each layer. And furthermore, from layer to layer, they undergo a twist. The highest order of liquid crystal material that's currently known is this group here, known as smectic. And here they are again in layers, but within each layer they are perpendicular to the layer and parallel to each other, and in general do not migrate freely from one layer to another. It's this class of material, the pneumatic, that is used in all commercial displays. And although there's a great deal of work been done at the research and development level, I should say commercial displays, ones that are being offered for sale now, there's a great deal of work at the R&D level in the cholesterics, and more recently, I'm aware that Fred Kahn has done some work with the smectic materials. Next slide. shows a typical device configuration for a liquid crystal display. It consists of a sandwich of glass. There are conducting electrodes on both pieces of glass. One is divided into segments, the information that you want to present. Here we're showing a 7-bar. On the other piece of glass, the electrode is a continuous ground plane that is directly opposite the individual segments. The spacing between the pieces of glass is about 0.5 mil, and the liquid fills that space. The liquid that lies between the two electrodes can be subjected to an electric field, and depending upon the type of liquid that you've chosen and the type of alignment that you've incurred in the liquid, you can either make a field effect or a dynamic scattering display. The next slide, please, shows the state for a dynamic scattering display. The liquid in the quiescent state is aligned either perpendicularly to the electrodes or parallel. Initially, at time zero, when the field is on, the liquid takes up an alignment. I've shown it more inclined here than it really is. It's a small angle to the plates. Once current begins to flow, the current carriers here disrupt the lattice structure, if you want to call it that. And this disruption propagates some distance away from the path of the ion and disturbs the surrounding material. That portion of the liquid crystal material, which is has been so disturbed, becomes a strong scatterer of light, and the visual effect is one of a frosted piece of glass. I may have the next slide, please. Dynamic scattering displays are made in three forms. Transmission style, which is intended for backlighting with the scattering of the light towards the viewer. A fully reflective style, which is intended to operate off the ambient light, scattered off the mirror in the cell and back to the viewer. And on the next slide, a partially reflecting or semi-transparent mirror, which can operate both ways, depending on which is the dominant form of lighting. Now, quickly, I'll just describe the field effect principles so that you're acquainted with that, and then I'll go on with the showing of the displays. Field effect liquids also use pneumatic liquid crystals, but in this case, the dielectric anisotropy is positive as opposed to negative in the case of dynamic scattering. And the molecular orientation is known as twisted pneumatic. May I have the next slide, please? In this molecular orientation, the molecules lie parallel to the two surfaces, which are represented by these lines at the top and the bottom of the figure. The horizontal bars in between represent the molecular axis, and the shortening as you come down is intended to represent a twist. The molecule undergoes a 90-degree twist going from one surface to another, here shown at this surface and this surface. When the field is turned on, because of the anisotropy of the liquid, those molecules that are in the bulk flip upright, as shown by this line, which is intended to represent the director of the molecules. The consequences of this are that if plane polarized light, which has the plane of polarization parallel to the surface, is passed through such a liquid while in the quiescent state, the plane of polarization is rotated by 90 degrees, the same amount as the liquid crystal molecules rotate. In this case, because the vast majority of the molecules are standing almost on end, there is no rotation of the liquid, so that of the plane of polarization, so that going from field off to field on, the plane is either rotated 90 here or rotated not at all here. The internals of the display are the same as I've already shown for the dynamic scattering, but you have to add polarizers to the display in order to actually see a visual effect. And this is shown on the next slide, please. Here is the display itself. The incident light passes through this polarizer, is rotated in the display, and in the first instance where the analyzer is crossed with the polarizer, the light is transmitted. When the field is turned on here, as I just said, there is no rotation of the plane of polarization and no light is transmitted by the analyzer. The effect in this case is that of a black digit on a white background. And if you orient the polarizer and the analyzer parallel, you can generate the reverse, a white digit on a black background. These displays can be operated reflective mode, transmissive mode, but I don't believe they're really effective in this semi-transparent mode due to the multiple loss of light through the partially transmitting mirror and the polarizers. These are also known as normally open and normally closed displays, this top one being known as normally open and this one normally closed. And I think the reason is obvious. It's a light absorber, and in this case it lets the light through in the open position. Here it does not let it through when it's not energized. It seems to me, in thinking about liquid crystal displays, that one of the major differences between liquid crystal displays and other forms of display is the fact that they have illumination requirements. They're not light generators, and therefore you must apply light to the display in order to see it. The light can either come from the ambient conditions or deliberate arrangements of lamps which will cast the light into the display. What this means to the equipment designer is that he has to be capable of solving these lighting problems, both to be able to see the display and to be able to have some pleasing visual effects. I personally think it's better if the component manufacturer, us, or those other people making the displays, would be better if these people would generate some standardized solutions to the lighting so that the equipment designer can again begin to consider this form of display as a light-emitting display, rather than having to deal with these lighting problems. So I think this perhaps is one of the problems that has faced the equipment designer and perhaps to some degree has held back the application of field effect displays and dynamic scattering displays. So the next part of my presentation is going to deal with various lighting techniques and the effects that you get. In transmission displays, very simple rule applies, but depending on how clever you are, the results can be variable. I think we can do without that. Thank you. The rule is simply that in dynamic scattering transmission displays, you simply have got to direct the light through the display, through the scattering region, but direct it in such a way that it doesn't come directly into the viewer's eyes. You not only have to have the main direction of lighting not along his viewing axis, but you've also got to shield the source of the light from his view. And source, in this case, can mean many things, as you'll see in a few minutes. The first type I want to talk about is the dynamic scattering transmission display that I call see-through. And I can just quickly look at the next slide, please. In this display, it's a fully transmitting display, and there is no deliberate lighting, but light bouncing from all places in the room passes through the display, and you get scattered light in the active regions. Now, in this case, a source is this wall, or the white surface of the table, if it happens to be white. So this form of display can be very effective and very pleasant looking in such things as high quality luxury clocks that are going to sit on a walnut desk where you have dark, or in a walnut panel room, for example, where you have dark walls and you're not bothered by looking at white sources. Now, if we may have the lights again for a moment, please. This is what I mean by a see-through type of display. Now, I really, at this point, don't know how well you can see it from where you are, but I would guess that you're probably having some difficulty seeing it against this diffuse background here. And if you get some, what I would call a non-source background, then it becomes much more visible. There's another form of this, this type of display that's used in advertising, and the firm that's done the most with this so far is the Ashley Butler firm. And they, in order to eliminate this problem of white walls, white shirts, and other things that you can't control, they'll provide a small backlight out of the line of view, and you can see that there's a rapid change in the effect with just some minor amount of backlighting. And I think this gives a very nice looking display in general for advertising purposes, clock, and other more luxury forms. Display, as you can see, is clear, almost perfectly transparent in the absence of a field. The more common method of lighting a transmission display is what I would call a cavity mount. And I've got two forms of that here. Perhaps I'd better have the next slide for just a moment. Oh, that's the backlighted see-through display that I just showed. May I have the next, please? In the cavity mount, you generally try to get the lamp located in such a position that the light comes through the display unscattered in a direction, not in the direction of the viewing cone. And you try to generate some kind of a matte black interior so that you see this black background when you look at the display. And this is a mock-up I made specifically for this. I don't think you would really mount things quite this way in an instrument, but I did it in order to be able to show it. On this side is what I would call the transmission cavity mount display. You can see I've got a black cavity back there, and the lamp is down here out of the line of sight. I've got quite a bit of lighting power here to try to make the thing visible to the back of the room. This display on this side I'll come back to in just a moment. There's another form of cavity mount which utilizes a lighting louver or light control film. And North American Rockwell has provided me with an example of this. In this case, instead of resorting to a black cavity, they've created a cavity effect by this Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing light control film, which is essentially a small Venetian blind. The lamp projects its light through the blind, and your normal viewing position is such that you don't look through the Venetian blind, but look transverse to it, and you get this dark look. You can see if I orient it, it's a little bit small for some of you in the back, but five to go? I better move rapidly here. You can see that you can see through the blind. I think I'll very quickly describe this, the rest of the displays without benefit of slides, I think, in order to move along here. This display on the right, on my left, on your left, is a semi-reflecting display which uses the partial mirror. You can see it operates off the room light. It is capable of operating with edge lighting. If I can turn off the lights, please. If I can get in front of this, you can see that edge lighting is suitable for this display and such things as cockpit or aircraft or automobile instrumentation.
In all justice here, I think I better switch right now to the field effect displays, just to give you a visual impression of this. This display is made by the International Liquid Crystal Company, Elixco, and has been incorporated in a digital panel meter by Tekelec. It's a very bright display. There's half a watt of lighting power here. I've got a 9-volt battery on it, and you can see that if I switch the battery, I can quickly change the output. It isn't necessary to turn the lights out if I may have them back on. You can see the display is very visible in normal lighting conditions with only half a watt of lighting power. I think I would like to just show the slides as to how this effect is achieved. So can you just index forward there, please? Next one. Keep going, please. Another one, please. In this case, you can see the one arrangement is to operate with a backlight going through a diffuser, then through the polarizers. Through the polarizer, the display, and the analyzer. Depending on the orientation, you can either get this type of format or this. The orientation of the polarizers, I should say. Next slide. A reflective display can be made by substituting a diffuse mirror back here, a non-depolarizing mirror. And on the next slide, this is the lighting scheme that is present in the instrument I'm holding in my hand. There is a plastic block behind the display with a reflector behind it, a small lamp in the block. The light output from the lamp is bounced in the display and projected forward. Bounced in the plastic block and projected forward through the display. This can operate either reflective mode with light coming in, bouncing off the reflector and coming back, or by transmission mode, depending on which is the dominant form of lighting. I think I had some additional commentary on lifetimes. I think perhaps in view of letting the other speakers, I'll reserve those remarks for the period that will follow. Have I run out of time?
Let me comment, for those that are interested in seeing the displays a little closer up, that they will be available for viewing after the session. Right now, I'd like to open up for a few minutes of questions. I would ask that you stand, and if you like, you can use the microphone, and please identify yourself by name and company. First question? Yes.
John Williams, Grumman Air Space Division. What are the lifetimes? And might ask, are there any special techniques for aligning the molecules on the glass surfaces so they lie flat this way and on that surface that? Mm-hmm.
Just a moment. Can you hear in the back?
No. Question was, what are the lifetimes? And second question, are there any special techniques that can be described for making the molecules take up the molecular alignment that you need for the various forms of display? I can only speak from my experience on lifetimes. You get into a sensitive area there, with competitors. It's my feeling from what we've seen, plus what I know about what other people are doing, that the lifetime before you begin to see any detectable flaw at all is 2 or 3 years, at least. And that the lifetime before the flaws develop to the level where you would say it's unacceptable now, I wanted to replace it, is years beyond that. I just don't know how far out it is. But our experience is that it is a long time. Later we probably hear from some of the other manufacturers of displays if they want to chime in on this. But as for molecular alignment, there, I think you get into a very proprietary area as to how it's done. People use dopants in the liquid. Some people do chemical reactions on the surface. Others use rubbing techniques on the surface to generate the alignment. There have been several published papers on this subject. Fred Kahn, who's in the room, just recently published on this. There have been others at Bell Laboratories who've done some publishing, and I think I'd rather refer you to what's in the literature rather than tell you what we do.
Yes?
Bradley, Engineer Topographic Labs. I just wanted to make an addition as an answer with reference to the life of the liquid crystal. The Committee on Determining the Standards for Life Testing is having a hard time to define life.
Well, that's true, yeah.
Because under what conditions should it be defined and how many imperfections are to be allowed? So the question so far is vague until that problem is set.
The point is that catastrophic failure does not seem to be the thing that concerns people most. It's the gradual degradation, and the definition of how far is too far and just how you're going to measure it is the most difficult thing to answer.
Yes?
Thomas Cogburn, Texas A&M University. Could you tell me what the present temperature ranges are on the liquid crystal display?
Well, I'm aware of liquids that will operate from minus 20 centigrade to almost plus 100 centigrade. At the higher end, I think you probably get, in most instances, will get into an acceleration of degradation. The display will operate, but probably the life will be shortened. At the low end, I don't know of any such effects. Even if you freeze the display, it's my experience is that they recover once they've thawed out, and you don't see any after effects.
Is there a Mr. Will Garth attending this session? Does anyone know him, Will Garth? It's an emergency that he contact Mr. Schumacher as soon as possible. Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
On the redox field, this is more or less an experimental view from what I can hear from many people. How many years will it take until you can get down to the practical science or business-wise?
For these displays?
Well, what I mean is in instrument field also.
Well, I think it is there now. There are more than one company that I'm aware of that are producing displays in what I would consider industrial volumes, liquid crystal displays.
Was your question was how to evaluate the display, sir?
Business-wise, for the future. Right now, we don't have a volume on this work, liquid crystal. More or less experimental.
No, I wouldn't say so at all. North American Rockwell is, Mr. Tannis could probably answer that question.
Maybe I can comment. We're making displays in the volume of approximately 40 to 60,000 a month. 8 characters per sandwich, half inch size characters, I didn't gather. Considering the age of the technology, I think liquid crystals is coming along extremely fast. Probably in another 5 years, you will see them used in an extremely large volume of types of applications. And perhaps, you mentioned it, but I think you have to look very closely at what a liquid crystal is, because it's a completely different phenomenon. As a consequence, it in itself generates new product potential, opens up new areas where electronics can be used that weren't used before because of unique characteristics. So it shouldn't be viewed as perhaps a device that replaces the LED or something like that. It has a wider potential.
Thank you, and I think we can explore this a little further during the panel session. I think I'll defer questions now, and we'll move on into the next paper so we don't get too far behind schedule. Our next paper will be on LED displays in your instrument by Bob Stewart of Hewlett-Packard Associates. Bob got his BSEE from San Jose State and an MSEE from Stanford in 1969. Since 1969, he's been at HPA working on LED displays, and he's currently applications manager of the electro-optics department. Bob?
My watch off so I can find out what time it is. Is the sound level adequate in the back? Okay. What I'll be talking about today is pretty much a survey of LEDs. The title is LEDs in Your Instrument, a Systems View. And I'll be using that word several times because I'm going to try and present the total picture as far as all the different factors which affect instrument design, not just the component itself, but its use and to an optimal point. Now, because of the limitation of time, I won't have a chance to cover all the facts or all the details published in the reprint. If you have questions on that, we can cover them in detail either in the question period or possibly later in the panel discussion. What I'd like to do now is start by bringing up the first slide. First of all, let's define LEDs. Just a quick definition. We can describe them as a semiconductor, a PN junction, that has a curious property of emitting light when excited electrons fall back to the normal state. Let's not go into the physics any further, except to know that the materials most commonly used are gallium arsenide phosphide and gallium phosphide, former producing red rather efficiently, the latter through different doping materials can be used in either green or red. What about the forward characteristics? This is very important if we're going to use it correctly. Now, the simple PN junction, we do note the higher turn-on voltage of 1.6 volts as opposed to the much lower values that we're used to for silicon and germanium. You might note that while it doesn't have anything to do with displays, you might take advantage of that 1.6 volts in some applications where you want a high voltage reference as opposed to just using a standard silicon junction. We note that because it is a forward characteristic of a diode, we have to be very careful how we operate it. Just from the standpoint of getting a good quality display, if we're operating only on a voltage bias, a small change in that bias causes a rather large increase in not only the current, but the light that we get out. So we want to current limit our display at a certain value to get an even quality in our final system. Next slide, please. So there are really several ways of doing this. For example, one way is shown in the top, is in this series drive line to put a current limiting resistor. This is the most common way of doing it, where we get a negative feedback type of system, because any current surge which might go through that due to a change in the bias at this point is limited. That current surge, of course, increases the voltage drop across the resistor and our display is buffered. We note that this is a very common way to drive LEDs. And of course, it's very easy to turn on and easy to turn off. Now, a disadvantage of that approach is that we're using a power dissipating element to limit our current. Another technique shown in the bottom, where we replace that with a more ideal energy storage element. In this case, an inductor, where our drive technique is to turn on this transistor while leaving this one off and charge up to a specified current value. Then, after that's been done, we discharge that current through the desired LED by reversing the on and off states of those transistors, allowing the current to dissipate through the desired LEDs. Now, in a typical driving scheme, what we might do is use this in a pulse mode where we're driving several 7-segment digits, one digit at a time. So we're really using these switches as XY addresses. And what we might do is, if we have an XY type of system of segments, might do is go back and charge up those inductors corresponding to the particular segments that we want to excite in the next time period through choosing which inductors are going to be on. In this case, we might choose 8 inductors, one for each segment, and a decimal point. After we've charged up the ones corresponding to the segments we want, we merely connect the proper transistor on so that that information is displayed at the proper digit location. Now, we talked about the purpose of this latter technique is to save power. On the average, these two LEDs are operating at about the same average efficiency. we find that the lower drive stage consumes one half the power of the upper drive stage. So it's that power is its main main selling point. Disadvantage is the fact that the timing is more complex. We want to make sure that there's a little bit of overlap in on times. Stored current tends to want to go someplace, and if we don't give it one, it'll find one. And second fact is that the inductors can be rather space-consuming for very long pulse lengths. Might also add that we talked about the low voltage here. We note the low voltage here, and off the screen is a 5-volt supply. LEDs are very easy to interface with low voltage types of logic. Now, this is more than just the typical TTL. We find that in instruments of the next generation that not just standard P-channel MOS, but N-channel is becoming very popular because of the speeds and densities and some other applications. N-channel has not only a high current capability, but it also has the advantage of working off a single 5-volt supply. So we find that LEDs can be interfaced rather easily to these low voltage supplies, and they can, of course, easily work with the 15-volt breakdown types of voltages present on an N-channel device, assuming no back bias. Next slide. The next factor we'd like to talk about is LED efficiency. Now, here I use the word intensity, and if I were to rephrase that, I would probably call it light out per unit current in, kind of a measure of performance where we operate at a higher efficiency at the more that we drive it. The reason for this is that at very low current levels, the internal trapping centers that absorb photons are rather effective in their job. But as we increase the current level, we find that those centers get saturated, and they, as a percent of the total light produced internally, we get more and more of it out. So we see a very sharp rise, and then starting to plateau as we get into current limiting. This is up around the range of 100 amps per square centimeter or beyond that. Current limiting, that's just getting a large amount of current through a very small space. We're kind of familiar with that because we're seeing it every afternoon, or particularly on Fridays. We call it the Friday freeway problem. Next slide, please. Now, we can take that fancy curve and put it in a more useful form by plotting average light output versus average current as a function of several duty cycles. And we see that we can obtain this is, of course, for pulsing when we're working in duty cycle or strobing. Our peak current limit is obtained by dividing the average by the duty cycle. And this is for approximately 3/10 of an inch display in the present and future generations now being introduced of LED displays. Might note that for the engineer working with, let's just make it easy, a 10-digit system, if he was just doing it in the easiest way possible, he'd probably work with a 1 of 10 duty cycle. But yet, that may result in operating at a very low point in that efficiency curve that that we just showed. So if he's working in this range at all, and he went to a lower duty cycle than would be first suggested by the number of digits, we find that for the same current range, he can move up, and without increasing power, he can substantially increase his light output. Or if the light's adequate, he can move to the left. That's real nice, because he cut his power. Next slide. These slides are for gallium arsenide phosphide, by the way. Now, there's other things that can be done in the way of parts, not only using them, but as far as the manufacturer's packaging of devices. LEDs, in general, are a very young industry compared with some of the older techniques, and so that we're just starting to learn how to get the most for our money, how to get the most for our packaging. And one example of this is magnification, something that was introduced about a year ago in the first display. And, of course, its major effect at first glance is to magnify the character, reduce the amount of material we need to dedicate to our display. But there's something else that's done, in that in magnification, we are actually substantially increasing the amount of light we pull out of that package, not just rearranging the light into a different angular pattern, but pulling out more. And we can see this if we go back on a flat display. We note how that the light is bent, and at a certain incident angle, here about 26 degrees for plastic and air, that light will be internally reflected. All light rays impinging at an angle greater than that will be lost. Those same rays, when interfacing to a domed lens, if you will, have their incident angle changed, and therefore we're coupling out more of the light. The actual relationship is that the light output increases by the square of the magnification with reference to a flat display. Now, the trade-off, you never get something for nothing, is that we are restricting the viewing angle at higher degrees of magnification. The several displays were have been introduced using this type of technique. As an example, we can double the amount of light output and still have a plus or minus 45 degree viewing angle in the vertical, plus or minus 35 in the horizontal. Next slide. Now, the next thing we'll be talking about in packaging is the next generation of displays. And that's what can be done with the actual part. Or if we go back and review the first LED displays that were introduced in a 7-segment format, we find that 2 LEDs were used per segment. This was kind of, they were separately die-attached, wired, and then just illuminated in a plastic package. What was first done by OpCoS quite a while ago, and now almost everybody's doing it, or will be doing it in the next month, is take a single LED dot, one per segment, and to optically stretch it up to a taller or wider segment. Now, several displays have been, as I said, introduced in the last couple of months, and you'll see all major manufacturers introducing or having one within the next couple of months. Several advantages of this. Of course, we reduce the amount of gallium arsenide phosphide needed. That's a major advantage. We also reduce the assembly costs. We also find that there are several ways of doing this, and every manufacturer has his own favorite. But basically what's being done is that we're having some type of a box in between the back, the mounting area, the substrate, and the front surface. This box has 7 slits in it, the bottom of which is a LED, and there's all kinds of shapes and different ways of either reflecting or diffusing or using a light pipe to spread this light very evenly to a full segment. We find that in early displays there were lines and hot spots. We're not seeing that in future generations or present day types of displays. Okay, could I have the next slide then? Okay, we talked about systems. Right now I'd like to cover briefly displays that have integrated circuits inside. You see here a chart of a typical display system, and we see that it's very common or would be very advantageous to include all these functions within a actually the display module. That's therefore increasing the scale of integration to lower the designer's time and of course reduce the number of components he has to work with. So we find that this was actually done a couple of years ago, numeric displays having ICs inside, typically bipolar, that would not only do decoding, but would have special functions such as memory and counting. We also can also find that we can take advantage of this for custom arrays and also working with new alphanumeric systems. I'm going to probably spend some time in the discussion period talking about the future, and I'll take some time to talk about that at that point. Next slide, please. Now we can, just one quick example of how we can make use of that. We find that here we have a display with an onboard memory and a decoder and a driver. And we can interface very easily to character serial bit parallel data. That is, the information is arriving one word at a time, one word per character, but character sequential. And the local memory inside this makes it very easy to latch in that data and thereby free the previous memory from for other I/O functions. Next slide. Now, the next thing we'd like to work with is driving when we don't have an IC on board. The obvious way to do it for a small number of characters is to interface a BCD to 7-segment decoder on a 1-to-1 basis with each digit. This is very easy to do. However, there's, of course, a limit. You start to get up around 4 and 5 digits, and it's more expensive to add decoders than it is to just invest in some simple time sharing or strobing schemes where we turn on only one digit at a time and multiplex the information. In the next slide, we show a summary chart of many of the different decoders and decoder drivers available today. There are a lot of the old parts available, but there are some new ones that are particularly interesting to look at. For example, for quite a while we had the familiar 7447A, which could sync 40 or more milliamps, approximately 40, per line and qualified as a decoder and a driver for pulse mode operation. This was for common anode. Common cathode didn't have an equivalent until a couple of months ago when Computer Microtechnology and then later second source by Precision Dynamics introduced a 50 milliamp per line current source. These are decoder drivers with a high current output. We also see how the input current has been lowered down into the microamp range make it extremely easy to interface several to MOS circuits. You might note that the major manufacturers are working on similar circuits. We expect to see at least a couple of them in the first part of this year. I might also note, just for your reference, a hybrid device that should you need a high packing density and wish to pay the price for a hybrid, we do have a very high current driver available to us. Next slide. What about strobing? Now, this is where we turn on only one digit at a time and timeshare or multiplex this decoder. Well, if here we show a simple 7447A working in a system, we might note that the very easy to interface to the very common data form, and that's again this character serial bit parallel form, where the there are, let's say, three reasons for this. First of all, it saves power in the LED because we're operating in a pulse mode up much farther up on that efficiency curve. Second of all, we can see how it can save pins in our display since we have an XY type of address. That's very advantageous. And third, it's a very common type of character format coming out directly from today's MSI and LSI. The guys at the other end out here want to save pins too, so it's very common for them to structure things in a character serial bit parallel format. Next slide. Another technique for presenting the information in a strobe fashion is to use shift registers to store the data. Here what we've done is we've brought the information in through a steering network just to allow recirculating back the information. And each of the four BCD bits is, for all characters, here a five-digit display, is accessed and held in a shift register. We also note we're using a shift register as a scanner. Both these techniques allow a great flexibility in moving the number of digits. We're working here with 5-bit shift registers. They were serial in, parallel out, let's say on an 8-bit or whatever register. We could just pull this information out at whatever point we wanted and could modify this basic structure for quite a wide range of character lengths. We might note that point of flexibility. Because displays many times are available in single-digit formats, very easy to generate 3, 4, 5, 6-digit displays today. Next slide. Now, the next couple of things I'd like to talk about involve working with the display in its ambient, in the operating condition. For example, if we are working in a normal ambient condition where the light changes only over a small range, we can preset the light output and not have any problems. But what happens if we're operating in a mode just like what we experience now? There's a wide change in the ambient conditions. That could be a television set in a consumer application, or it could be a special instrument used with a scope where it's a very fast scope and somebody might be turning down the ambience. Then we can work with something called pulse width modulation to control the output, turning things off for a certain percentage of the time. The next slide, we show a couple of ways of doing that. What we've done here, for example, is to use a one-shot to generate a series of pulses from a scan clock. And, of course, we can vary the width of those pulses by the use of varying this resistor. And if we use a Clarix photoresistor, it tracks pretty well the ambient. Or we might use to generate those series of pulses, we might use a phototransistor, which is then compared with a ramp generator. Again, the duty cycle going into the blanking control is varied as a function of the ambient. Next slide, please. Another way to improve contrast is to put filters in front of our display, such as a red plexiglass filter, as shown by this characteristic. The advantage of this system is its cost, very inexpensive, less than a penny per square inch, and easily molded and available in a wide range of configurations. It's effective because for red LED displays, we find that it passes rather well the red LED light while attenuating other wavelengths. And that works very well in ambient because, of course, most of the ambient lies outside the red. Next slide, please. Another technique that's particularly effective for high ambient conditions and also works well for green displays where the ambient is coincident with the LED's light is a circular polarizing filter. Here, the HRCP red from Polaroid. And it works on the principle that by telling the difference between light which has to go through the filter twice, that is the ambient, and LED light which need go through only once, we see the tremendous improvement in contrast ratio between the two transmissivity characteristics. But because of a polarizer that's present, we find the transmissivity is about half of the former filter. Next slide. We then find that in addition to this, we can work with a third type of filter. In fact, Bob mentioned it a little earlier. These are the microlouvers. That's all. Microlouvers, or miniature Venetian blinds, as I call them, from 3M. Venetian blinds, if you can imagine them in their open condition, except what we use them here for is that as a set of blinders where the light is projected out, but overhead ambient and other conditions are blocked. They're inexpensive enough to be used today in traffic light controls and are being seriously considered by the automotive industry. Now, what about actually improving contrast in your system design? What should you be doing as a instrument designer to get the most, get the highest contrast? Well, things that you can do include looking at plastic devices that have a red dye inside the plastic, or ones that have a dark substrate. You might also look at laying out your PC board such that you avoid running those metal lines near the display. They're rather reflective. Better yet, run them on the backside when you have to bring them into the display or underneath the display itself. You might go to the next step of taking a black epoxy ink and screening it over the PC board in a thick film fashion. Ink such as Warno's WON black epoxy ink out of Burbank. Or you might take a simple cardboard cutout and place it around the display as a collar. Something else we have to worry about is reflections off the front surface. You can use anti-reflecting coatings, such as available from Panel Graphic, or high-quality ones that can lower the reflectance to 0.25%. Now, something else that you can do, if you're molding the front window, and this was done on the HP35, where if you take a look at the very center window of one of these calculators, there's a very slight matte finish to it. I'm not talking about the pebbly outer ring, but the center ring, or center surface, is not polished. Is a very, very slight matte finish, and this diffuses the bounce from overhead lights and helps appreciably in getting that contrast up. So we've looked at LED displays and the ways to drive them, the ways to use them most efficiently, and to increase the contrast ratio, because of course we see how important it is. Now, I guess the overall theme is to not just treat the display component as another resistor or another capacitive component. If we tend to do that, we're not going to get the most for our money. It's a part of a very complex system, a man-machine interface. And unless we take advantage of all these different options available to us and design around them, not only won't we be optimal, we won't even be competitive. People are learning how to use displays and get the most for their money. Any questions?
We now have time for a few questions before the next paper. Okay, then if there aren't any questions, we'll move on into the next paper.
Unstring me.
The next paper will be Alphanumeric and Numeric Display Devices for Instrument Applications by John Pittman of Burroughs. John obtained his BSEE from the University of Texas in 1954, and since 1957, he's been with Burroughs. He presently is the product marketing manager. John?
Having suffered through two intense waves of stage fright, I seem to have calmed down a little bit, so if you bear with me, I think we'll get started. Al Sokolowski, some of you may know, is editor of Electronic Engineering. They've recently been on a K kick that as time goes on, the engineer is going to be judged more and more by the value of what he produces, not entirely on how well it works. The name of the game is going to be value more than the utmost in performance. And I think this is a manifestation of the shift from the military to the industrial and commercial consumer type applications, where there's a far bigger premium on the dollar value of the product than there was some years ago. I first started in the display business, was literally told on more than one occasion by engineers that they didn't really care how much it cost if it was better. And I think that now the question is it good enough and is the price right? If you can turn on the view graph here, try to put a historical perspective on this. Most all of my experience has been in the display field, and Nixie tubes were the thing I got involved with first. This list was prepared by an electronic engineer. It probably leaves out some salient, significant things, but the point I wanted to make with it is that if you look, in 1955, first entry, they mentioned the Nixie tube being introduced by the Burroughs people. Dropping down here to 1970, we're roughly halfway down the list, is 15 years, and the remaining half of the list is the last 2 or 3 years. So there's been a major bursting forth of developments in the readout technology. I think that this is a manifestation of two important factors. One, the introduction of low-cost MOS circuitry, which have made a lot of things feasible which previously just weren't practical either because of size or cost or some other related factor, and the mini-computer, with the mini-computer having particular significance in applications where you want alphanumeric displays. Going in parallel with this have been developments in the closely related technology of drivers for readouts. One of the first major breakthroughs was in 1960, at least as far as Nixie tubes were concerned, when a relatively low-cost PNP, high-voltage transistor, became available. This was at perhaps a dollar or a little less per device. You needed 10 of them per Nixie tube, and it really wasn't, well, everybody thought that was a big breakthrough. But in today's view, that isn't very impressive. About 2 years later, a 100-volt NPN transistor came on the market. It, too, was at a dollar a digit. People were very impressed with this, and there were lots of them used, at least in that day's figures. Some of the key facts, factors in this list, which I might mention, was that in 1955, the first Nixie tubes were announced. 1957, a projection display by Industrial Electronic Engineering. It incidentally still used certain applications where it's projection of predetermined messages from films is useful. 1963, the first alphanumeric Nixie tubes. These were used in largest volume in stock market displays. At that time, the gas tube technology was expanded through entry into the market of in the U.S. of Amperex, National Electronics, several manufacturers in Japan. 1967, lower cost series of numeric indicators. 1968, first commercial LEDs. 1969, a self-scan display, which is an alphanumeric gas discharge display. 1969, also the RCA Numatron. 1970, liquid crystals. 1970, also the Burroughs Panaplex 1. 72, the Panaplex 2. 1971 was a company called Sperry with another entry into the gas discharge business. In the course of this time, there have been a lot of technical developments, but I think one of the more interesting ones to the people who are interested in present-day commercial application is the cost trends. If you'll show the next transparency. This curve is sort of an eyeball kind of thing. It's relatively closely related to real numbers, but a lot depends on what you want to define. I chose to include not only the display device itself, but also closely related driver circuitry, and at least it gives you an order of magnitude. When I first began working in the display field, small quantities of numeric counters went for on the order of $100 a decade. If you were a large volume manufacturer, you could, of course, get it considerably cheaper, but you still had four vacuum tubes and circuitry and whatnot, and when you got through a device that wasn't terribly stable and didn't have exceptionally good life, on top of which it consumed a lot of power. Throughout the years, alphanumeric displays have been substantially more expensive, as you can see from the comparison between the two curves. I guess the most interest to people is what happens down in the 73 to 1980 thing there, and all I can say is that all the indications are that it's going to continue to drop sharply, and of course, as a manufacturer, I'd like to see the decline slow, and as a user, you'd like to see it fast, and probably it'll be closer to what you like than what we'd like. The previous two speakers, I think, have covered liquid crystals quite well, and also the LEDs. I have prepared some summaries, though, which will give you a rather quick look at what these comparisons are like. Shift it down. I doubt that all of you in the back can see this, but LEDs and the gas discharge devices are very comparable as to for operating speed, with the LEDs probably having the edge, but both of them being fast enough for most of the operations that I'm familiar with, and certainly fast enough to multiplex well. Liquid crystals are sort of a second, and again, while they're relatively slow, they're fast enough for a lot of very big and worthwhile applications. The there are a number of other significant areas for comparison, but I think that as far as reliability is concerned, it's safe to say that both the LEDs and the gas discharge devices have more than sufficient reliability to make them suitable for large volume applications. The liquid crystals may also be adequately reliable. They're somewhat younger and have some inherent properties which make this a more difficult problem than it is for either LEDs or gas discharge. Color is another thing which a lot of people have looked at. With the gas discharge, for many years, it was sort of like Henry Ford. If you wanted a gas discharge display, you had the choice of orange, orange, or orange. And we have in recent times done some experimental work where we've put phosphors inside the envelope so that you could selectively energize the stuff. But this is sort of fairly exotic, and it's something that foreign to the mainstream of our current activity. One other comparison from the gas discharge and the LEDs is that LEDs don't lend themselves well to batch processing in the sense of you laying all of the light-emitting devices down simultaneously. It may be possible to integrate this, but you won't be able to get integrated, the economies that integrated circuits and LSI provide for logic, because you want a thing that's physically large enough to see. You want to have relatively small emitters, because the cost of the LED is related to the size and number of the emitters. This is why the reflective displays that we just described are being pushed. They use less material and give you a larger size character. But in the final analysis, they say you will still have to be put down individually. And with the gas discharge, you screen them all simultaneously and go on from there. The most significant thing in the way of numeric displays that Burroughs has done in the last several years has been what we call our Panaplex 2. This is a panel which is various lengths. Typically, they run anywhere from about 2 inches on out to well, we've made some that are about 18 inches long, and give character heights of 1/4 inch, 2/10 of an inch, 1/2 inch, 4/10 of an inch, and 0.7 inch. These are made by taking a ceramic substrate, screening a conductor pattern, then a dielectric layer, a segment pattern, another dielectric layer, and then sealing it in a sandwich with a front glass plate with a conductive anode on the inside surface, transparent, a spacer ring to maintain the front to back separation and a space for the gas, which is your active element, and then your cathodes where the glow discharge occurs. There's considerable freedom as to what patterns you can put down. You can change the character font relatively easy. It's a little more difficult, mainly just from logistics reasons, to change the size of your substrates. You have to tool and order them. And in fact, it was so flexible that we rapidly fell into the trap of proliferating so many types that it became a monstrous scheduling problem for us. The current time, we're producing 15 or 20 different configurations, much to the horror of our manufacturing people and much to my horror, since I have to help them schedule this stuff, and it seems that whatever the customer wants isn't what we happen to be producing at the moment. The Panaplex is used primarily in calculators. It hasn't been used much in instruments yet, primarily because the calculator market has come on so strong and so suddenly that it caught us and I think a lot of other people by surprise. I might mention in passing that in the fourth quarter of last year, we produced more Panaplexes than we produced in the preceding three quarters. In this quarter of the year, we will have produced more Panaplexes than we produced in all of last year, and we're still increasing our capacity. Our weekly production now exceeds what the number of digits that we produced on an annual basis no more than 4 or 5 years ago. That's businesses in addition to the alphanumeric self-scan, which we're also producing in substantial volumes. And since I participate in the forecasting, I've been under a certain cloud with as far as our engineering and manufacturing people, because I grossly underestimated the market and also how quickly it will build up. We're producing at the rate which we had projected for some period 2 or 3 years out from now. Those projections have been buried since. We don't talk about them too often. With the next chart, please. This is the comparison with liquid crystals. I think that in many respects I've touched on most of those points. Let's shift to the third one. The next one. Here's a comparison of gas discharge with CRT. CRTs are beginning to be used in some of the more sophisticated measuring and test equipment, particularly where you want to be able to use relatively unskilled workers. We've made comparisons which some people might argue with, but which at least give the general feel of it. The gas discharge has certainly got long life. One point I should certainly not miss is that the first long-life Nixie tubes were put on life test in 1958. There were 100 of them, and something like 90 of the 100 are still working, and if you have occasion to visit our factory and want to, we'll take you back and let you look at them. There have been many cases of people taking indicator tubes out of obsolete equipment and putting them in to new pieces of equipment for one reason or another. The gas discharge devices are such that properly manufactured, by that I mean not having the kind of manufacturing defects that lead to infant mortality failures, properly manufactured devices used in the recommended manner will last probably more than 20 years. A lot depends, I suppose, on how you use them, where you have the thing on continuously or whether you intermittently and whether it's scanning or static and so forth. But for practical purposes, the gas discharge devices we make have no life problem whatsoever. They also don't degrade much in brightness with time. The color is red, and you can get some relatively small shifts by using a red filter, and if you choose, you can make it look just like an LED. If you put a green filter on it, you can get a kind of pleasant greenish appearance, which is reminiscent of vacuum fluorescent displays, and but basically you get red-orange. How am I doing on time?
5 minutes? Good. Gee, it seems like I'm just getting started. I'm glad I skipped a lot of the material. I wanted to address what might be happening in the future. And there's a point I'd like to make because I think it's significant. Having confessed already that my crystal ball is sometimes clouded, you can take whatever projections I make with suitable grain of salt. But in the instruments field, how many people here are directly involved in designing or choosing devices for instruments? Well, it looks like a fairly substantial fraction. I ran across some figures in an annual report recently on a company that makes panel meters. They indicated that in 1972, they expected the total panel meter business to be on the order of $10 million. And 5 years, that was last year rather, 5 years from then, or 1977, they were expecting a market of on the order of $22 million. Now, of course, the panel meters are only a fraction of the total instrument business. But to put this in context, the readouts for calculators this year will exceed by far the $22 million figure projected for panel meters in 1977. Calculators, you can get forecasts of anywhere from 1.5 million to 25 million units in 1973, and you know, depending on how wild you want to be, you can pick a number. But it's a whole plateau higher in applications volume than the instruments business. I think this is going to have beneficial effects for the instruments market. It's supplying a very substantial base for the MOS houses. It's supporting a lot of effort in readouts, and I'm sure that with people in making the kind of investments they are currently, that the calculator market will not be unsaturated for very long. I'm sure most of you are aware there's a worldwide shortage of displays right now, primarily attributable to the calculator consumption. The Japanese aren't able to make enough readouts to satisfy their own market and haven't been very active in this country, thank goodness. And it's, you know, they said, what are you going to do for an encore? There's a lot of activity right now with clocks. There's some demonstration equipment here with liquid crystals. A number of MOS houses are building clock displays, four digits, some of them six digits. In order to be viable in this market, the cost per digit has to be somewhere down in the range well under a dollar, probably 50 cents or even less. And there's no reason why a display which is suitable for use in large production clocks won't also be useful in the instrumentation field. TV channel indicators are not far down the pike. Most of the TV manufacturers that we're acquainted with are actively working on digital tuners where it would be desirable to have a numeric readout. Frigidaire recently announced a digital oven for the home, if you can imagine that. I found that a little hard to believe at first. It does offer advantages because they have capacity switches so that you just touch spots on the panel and you can pre-program the oven to come up, run at a certain profile, cut off at a certain time, hold at a holding temperature, and do other fairly sophisticated things. You probably have to give the housewife a course in how to operate her oven, somewhat like they used to do with Singer sewing machines. But when you talk about displays for something like that, you're talking about markets which are staggering in comparison to the instruments field. And then, of course, you've got the whole automotive business, which looks like it's going to be cracking loose in the next several years. There you're talking about an environment which makes many of the military specs look easy, and volumes which look, again, staggering compared even to the calculator business. I think I've about run out of time. I'm willing to entertain questions if there's something that I could contribute at this point.
Thank you, John. We'll now entertain a few questions, and then we'll go into our discussion phase. Any questions? Okay, if there aren't any questions then, I think I'll call the speakers up and we'll go ahead and begin the discussion.
asking about overloads on gas discharge. I have a Victor calculator. Those discharges, when you turn it off, it discharges the condensers through the gas discharge.
No problem.
It flares up. It's very good.
If it doesn't hurt the other circuitry, it certainly won't hurt the tubes. The tubes are with the kind of current levels that you can get in a calculator. Extremely rugged.
You see, when it switches off, the capacitor discharge through the display, not the entire display. They just sort of take.
That's a common phenomenon. With our old demonstration equipment, you can unplug it and hold it up and watch the capacitor discharge.
It does not affect the overall life of the discharge.
No, the current levels are still small compared to what the thing has when it's running actively.
When I first saw it, thank you.
I think we'll go ahead and get started now. We've mentioned, I think, two key points in this talk so far. One are the display technologies, which we've discussed, but I think goes hand in hand with that is the real availability and implementation of large-scale integrated circuits to access these. And I think everyone has to admit that they're staggered by what's happened in the calculator market. And with the display cost coming down, the LSI circuitry coming down, keyboards coming down in price, I think this has to have a substantial impact on instruments, and instruments maybe which we aren't even considering at this time. What I would like to do in organizing this panel discussion is kind of give each of the members about 3 to 5 minutes to quickly summarize and perhaps make a few comments on what the other speakers said during the session. At that time, I would then like to go ahead and open up the discussion amongst the panel and the audience. I would hope that these statements and the preceding talks already have stimulated some questions in important areas of display appearance, the size, shape, color, format, different drive techniques available, power supply requirements, mounting, reliability and life, and one of the most important, cost, and particularly orient our discussion towards current and future applications to instruments. And I'll start off with Bob Clary.
Well, the few remarks I want to make at this time, in effect, try to cover a couple of things that I ran out of time to discuss rather than comment on the others. I think one of the major points that I failed to mention in the liquid crystal displays is that they are exceptionally good for outdoor or very high ambient level lighting conditions. They're self-regulating in that regard, especially the reflective type of displays. But even the transmission displays come up very strongly if you turn on a high-intensity lamp. I have one here, and I could perhaps do that a little bit later for anyone who's interested in seeing this. North American Rockwell provided me with a high-intensity lamp so that I could demonstrate this fact. The other thing that, too, is happening, and I heard this coming through in the other speakers as well, is that the new displays seem to be offering an unparalleled format variability. Liquid crystals does this very well. Size variability as well as pattern variability. As far as our area is concerned, the liquid crystal area, we can see that as those cost trends go down and down, that the liquid crystal display should be a display as it becomes more mature, can follow those cost trends very easily. So the application for this form of digital display would appear to be very wide, and very low-cost instrument or consumer-type devices are possible using the liquid crystal display as a digital output, and I gather from what I've heard probably the others as well. I think that might cover the additional ones I want.
Bob? In talking about the different aspects of cost and interfacing, why don't I break it down into three market segments. One I might describe as alphanumerics for instruments,
and the other is small displays for portable instruments, not just calculators, but portable DVMs and multimeters, and third, the more traditional type of instrument. First on alphanumeric, Dr. Larry Kravitz yesterday presented a very good paper on monolithic alphanumeric displays with onboard electronics in the session 33 on matrix displays. Not going to try and explain what he said here. There's not enough time, and he's much more qualified than I am. But it showed that a small monolithic solid-state alpha with gallium phosphide is feasible and very attractive, particularly as we're trying to squeeze a lot more character information, maybe up to 80 characters, in a reasonable rack size. Second, on portable instruments, we of course have the displays being produced in high volume for the portable calculator markets that interface, many of the displays interfacing direct to MOS without any buffers, except possibly at the digit lines, and their simple, inexpensive transistors can be used. And so we see costs coming down to a dollar and much below a dollar per digit. As far as instrument displays, the display is just introduced, and that we're talking about now in the next couple of months, where we're stretching a single segment to a full wide character, are very attractive. They still require simple transistors to interface to MOS, although they don't require any, they don't have any problems with breakdown voltages because they're low voltage displays. As far as the costs, this is a weird thing. The costs are coming down. They're still artificially high because of the supply and demand situation that John talked about. The 0.3 and 0.4 inch displays are going for $1.85 per digit in 10,000 digit quantity, and that's not that many instruments. And the costs are much below that today, and this type of stretching is brand new, and of course, as with any new device, the cost will drop quite substantially in the next in the near future. So costs, we expect, will be competitive. It's simple semiconductor assembly techniques done in high volume overseas, and pioneered, of course, with transistors and ICs. As far as efficiencies and interfaces, we see materials coming up, better ways of making the present materials and packaging, along with gallium phosphide, that will allow a direct MOS interface of 0.3 and 0.4 inch digits in the next, let's say, year and a half, maybe 2 years.
John? Well, I think I made the point at the beginning of my talk that Burroughs have been in the display business nearly 20 years now. For a large part of that time, the gas discharge display has been the dominant numeric display, and Burroughs is one of the leaders, if not the leader, in making electronic numeric indicators. One of the problems we have to contend with from a marketing viewpoint is that the newspapers are always looking for something to displace us because that's sensational, that's news. And over the last 4 or 5 years, we've had to put out a considerable amount of effort to persuade people that we weren't dead. The LEDs came along and they got a lot of play in the press, and it was intuitively obvious that the LEDs had to be better than gas discharge because they were low voltage. Now, of course, the proof of the pudding at the current time is that there are people who are willing to design LEDs out and design our gas discharge displays in handheld calculators on the basis of price. And on a net basis, the cost works out. Now, the situation is clouded, as we've mentioned, at the present time because of the shortage. And the proof of the pudding will be who gets what share of the market a year or 2 years out when there's no longer this temporary shortage. We think that looking at it from a very simplistic view, that the gas discharge display ought to be comparable in cost to liquid crystals. After all, the gas that you use in a gas discharge display probably doesn't cost as much as the liquid crystal material you use in a liquid crystal display. In both cases, you have a front and back glass plate or a ceramic and glass plate, and there isn't any major reason why the materials cost in liquid crystals should be less than what they are in a gas discharge display. I'm not quite as confident in comparing LEDs and gas discharge or liquid crystal because I don't know as much about the LED manufacturing costs and what their likely levels will be several years out. But I tend to be cautious in making those forecasts, because I said they'd never be able to get those ICs to work at an economical cost either. Yeah, that's one of my more famous projections. What I will say is that boroughs, several of the major people that I've talked to say that the dominant technology is likely to be the one that gets the most capital investment. A lot of people are investing in LEDs, but there are also a lot of people putting investment into gas discharge. Currently, you have Burroughs, Sperry, National Electronics, NEC, and two or three is Sony in Japan, Philips in Europe. A lot of people making major investments in the gas discharge technology. It's the kind of thing where you've got to be willing to put several million dollars worth of capital investment into it if you're going to have any chance at all of being successful. And all I can say is that we don't think that we're making a very big gamble with our money. With that, I'll close.
Thank you, John. I'd now like to open up for discussion with members on the floor in the panel. And from the floor, I request that you stand and give your name and company affiliation. Fred?
Fred Carnes, I'll ask. Some specific numbers were given on the cost figures on LEDs. I'd like to know what the present cost figures are from the manufacturers of what the crystals and plasma devices are represented. And along these lines, I find it very interesting that there are generations of calculators coming on the market with liquid crystal display, but these are turning out to be backlighted in the case of the North American display and in the case of the Tekelec panel meter, which uses an Elixir device. And one of the major advantages of liquid crystal is that it's a low power technology. And so if you use a lamp to backlight the device, you're not really taking advantage of the liquid crystal technology. So you have to ask yourself, why do people do this? And the only answer I can come up with must be possible. And I'd be very interested in hearing these numbers.
Could everyone in the back hear the question? Okay, Bob, you understand?
Cost is a hard thing for me to answer in general, because in some cases I'm probably talking about our competitors' costs, but what seems to me to be the case in surveying the situation is that four-digit displays of a format up to the size of this one can be had for $4 or less. And that's an inch and a quarter high character. You get the volumes way up, and in a couple of years from now, I would expect those to be down to $2. The thing about a liquid crystal display, and this really should be true, I guess, of a gas discharge, is that it's really not a cost per digit, it's the area involved. And so that if, as long as the area is approximately the same, an 8-digit display would be about the same price, practically the same price as a 4-digit. So you can be talking about very soon, I would feel, if not right now in some instances, 25 cents a digit for it.
Not right away, I hope.
I've forgotten some of the other...
The other part was the backlighting and current calculator models.
Well, the I'm not sure I know why North American chose to backlight instead of reflectively light. I don't personally think that that's such a impediment. After all, you're not switching the lighting power. And it, from what I've heard from the people who have to design the system, this is one of the major points. That you can handle lighting power as a steady state situation, and you can still keep the circuit cost down by the fact that you're not switching.
Okay, wouldn't you say the key reason for the backlighting is because reflective light they look lousy? As much as I love liquid crystals, I haven't seen a good reflective liquid crystal display.
Why do they look lousy? In your opinion.
Contrast ratio is not sufficient.
Yeah, contrast ratio, the angularities, front surface reflections.
Well, front surface reflections are a problem with them, but I have a North American calculator up here that's marketed under the Lloyd's name, in which I have a reflecting display, and if I pull the lamp on that,
I think you'd agree that it's a remarkably good-looking device. The North America apparently had reflective mode in mind when they designed this device, and you can hardly find any angle at which that calculator picks up an unwanted reflection. It's very readable.